Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. Looks like a bunch of you out there this morning. That's great. And we're going to have a nice warm week. Everything changes tomorrow. Tomorrow's day one, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Prices are going to go down, and it's going to be.
Temperatures are going to soar.
Yeah. Temperatures are going to soar. Yep, be entering the golden era. But anyway, it couldn't get worse. Let's say that. I don't think. So we'll look forward to.
It's interesting. He's not even in office yet. The influence he's had since the election.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's affected people's thinking, their outlook. It's just interesting. I was talking to Jeremy. We had breakfast this week about being an island and finding ways of dividing and picking versus trying to unify. It's easier to defeat single units, but when you get people working together, you have a strength in that message. And it's just more difficult to fight a group than it is individuals.
Indeed it is. May we learn from that, correct? It's so good to have the Bavarge with us this morning. And Clara, she's just a growing up. And we learned this week she likes to ride in a basket. She probably didn't even know that before this week, did she? Yeah. But anyway... Whenever you have a room full of adults that are trying to find ways to entertain a child, then you don't know what's going to happen, do you? But hopefully she won't go back home with too many bad habits that she learned here, and life will go on. Anyway, we've been studying in Luke chapter 14. Those of you that have been out for weather and one thing and another and sickness and whatnot... You haven't missed too many passages. There's still some stuff here. Last week we were reading here about some of the lessons that Jesus taught through parables. And the lessons here in chapter 14 seem to revolve around, well, food, right? Meals. We have Jesus was at a meal. He went to a Pharisee's house, and that brought on various conversation. And last week we saw how that he spoke of this great supper that was given, and how that people didn't come. And, of course, if you're the cook or the hostess, you can understand the frustration of that. But I want to talk for just a minute or two about a way we sometimes think about ideas like this as they're presented. Maybe you're familiar with the word motif. I know if you've had much education in music or the arts... that's something that they often talk about. And this is the first time I've... No, it's working for you. Okay. First time I've used the real version of Microsoft...
PowerPoint,
right? I've been using a knockoff version for years. But so motif... What is a motif? Well, here's a definition. A motif is an element or idea that recurs throughout a work of literature, of music. It's even used in biochemistry, I understand. If you have a certain cluster of molecules that gets repeated, biochemists talk about motifs. I didn't know that until I read it. So it's a word you might need to know to understand discussion about things. And so we're going to talk about it a little bit this morning. One thing to remember about the topic of food in Middle Eastern culture. Sharing a meal is a deeply significant act, representing hospitality, generosity, and a strong emphasis on community. Where food is used as a way to connect with others, welcome guests, and foster social bonds. It's considered more than just eating, but a way to show respect and kindness toward others by offering food and sharing a communal dining experience. Okay, so now that you know that, maybe that explains why some Christians are so excited about meals and food. I don't know. It's more than just eating, right? It's an act. It's an interaction. It's a sharing. And so, have you ever stopped to think about how many times food comes up in the Gospels and in the Gospel stories? There are a lot of things that occur around meals. There are a lot of lessons that Jesus gives with regard to meals. And we have, of course, the miracles of the feeding of great numbers of people speak in a way to the bigger picture of what he actually came to do, to meet the needs, to feed the spiritual hunger of a lost world. And so I want us to think a little bit this morning about this topic as a motif that is coming out, particularly in this chapter. Now, last week, I looked at the passage in Isaiah that I suggested was perhaps a backdrop for Jesus in this particular passage in Luke, where he's speaking of the great man, a certain man who had a great supper, and nobody came. It's a passage in Isaiah 25 where it speaks of the Lord of hosts making a feast unto all people. And so let's think for a moment about some of the concepts that come out of this, some of the concepts which may have been shocking to the disciples and the Jews in general. In Isaiah's passage, notice that this feast is to all people. And immediately for a Jew, that's an odd thing. That's a surprising thing. That's a bit of a shocking thing. The Jews had a very strict sense of boundary between the life that they lived, between their commitment to God and to where everybody else was. And you didn't associate with those that weren't a part of your group. You certainly didn't eat with them. After all, you don't know what they're eating and where it's been and how it might have been handled and what it might contain. I don't know. Maybe some of you have fears like that when you go to somebody else's house. What exactly is it that you're eating, right? Now, we have a fairly uniform culture in this part of the world, and so maybe you haven't really been totally panic-stricken by eating at somebody else's house around here. But if you were on the mission field in certain parts of the world, you'd probably have good reason to be a little concerned about what might be in that dish, and might be best not to know. For Jews, it was very important to know. And so a feast to all people, this sense of opening up to a wider group, to bring them close. You know, eating with somebody makes them a part of your life, makes them a part of your social circle. And that's not what the Jews thought of as what the future held. That's not where we're going. It's about keeping the boundaries in place and preserving them. And so we see Jesus in this passage in Luke 14 then, portraying a great supper which was prepared and then refused by those who had been invited. So first of all, that's a bit shocking within itself, to think that when a host had gone to this trouble to invite you, to make you a part of his life, to make you a part of the company at his table, that you would just blow it off with, well, I got some oxen I got to go prove, right? I got some ground I need to look at. I just bought. things like this. But then in addition, the response of the host is just as shocking. First of all, he instructs his servants to go out and invite basically the lower castes of that society, the streets and lanes of the city. So there's a bit of an indiscriminate canvassing for whoever's around, whoever might be available. That's not typically how you choose people to come and eat with you. And then the second classification there is the highways and the hedges. And those words speak of areas which are beyond the local boundaries. You're reaching out farther. And it seems that Jesus is preparing his disciples to think in terms that are uncomfortable to them. It's hard for us now sometimes to relate to how shocking it was when it first began to sink in to the disciples of Jesus that this salvation, this Christianity, was for everybody. It wasn't just for the Jews. They didn't see that coming. If you look in particular at Peter and his experience, it took three visions to even get him to go to the house of Cornelius. And then when he got there, he didn't know for sure why he was there. And when he found out why he was there, he's like, okay, like, here we go. I don't know where this is going exactly, but I clearly need to be here and need to do what needs to be done. And so then when he got back to Jerusalem, he was brought on the carpet. Why did you do this? Why did you go and eat with Gentiles? Why did you treat them as though they were a part of the promise of Israel, which was fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth? And he was like, it wasn't me, right? God did this. Here's what happened. I did what I had to do. I did what obviously I was being led to do. And so that's been 2,000 years ago. But when we read these passages in the New Testament, those events hadn't transpired yet. And so passages like this where Jesus is creating in their mind this foundation for thinking beyond their normal boundaries. It puts new light on some of these parables that he tells. There's more going on than us just saying, okay, I need to read this, and what do I have to do now? Right? So that's sometimes how we read the Bible. What is Jesus telling me to do? Well, we're taking an old snapshot of history here that is not the same setting, context that we live in. And we have to realize that to understand it. Now, we start out talking about a motif. And so, a motif is a repeated theme. So, in a song, if you just listen to half of the last chorus, you may not get the motif, right? You have to hear the whole song. And so some of these things may not be obvious to us just reading a verse or two or a small passage. But remember that the big picture for the Jews was the Old Testament, what they had been brought up with, what they had been taught, the law and the prophets. And so when we bring in then the bigger picture, we see there is this concept of eating, of a fellowship surrounding and associated with the worship of God. You know, the Old Testament is replete with festivals that involved eating. One of the prime dimensions of the worship of God was sacrifice, and then certain sacrifices the worshiper shared in. They partook of it. At times it was probably their main opportunity to have meat, because much of their food wasn't centered around a meat diet, as ours often is. And so this picture of a communal meal, and of course that's carried over into the New Testament with the Last Supper, the commemorative meal of the followers of Christ, and then ongoing the picture of them sharing together in memory of what he had done. So I think it adds a deeper dimension to understanding some of these passages if we think about the sharing of a meal in the broader sense that it was experienced by the Jews. So another message that comes out of this story in Luke 14 is not only does the host turn beyond the normal limits and boundaries to fill the seats of his feast, but he says, none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. So there's a very strong message that there's going to be a transition here in the circle of those who are welcome at the table. There's going to be a change. And if you were one of the listeners to the teaching of Jesus, you would have had to wonder just what all is going on here, what's going to happen. Okay, that brings us then to verse 25. And there were great multitudes with him, and he turned and said unto them, if any man come to me and hate not his father and his mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And then he goes on and kind of explains why they should know this. Now, those are really strong words. And the word translated hate there is a little shocking to us, I think. So it turns out that this word in the Greek has a wide range of meanings. And a lot wider than it would for us in English. So it ranges in meaning from disfavor to detest. It can mean to have little regard for, but it doesn't always mean to hate in the sense that we do, that we use it in English. And, you know, the translation from one language to another is a complicated thing. It's challenging, always challenging. But if we think here about what Jesus means to communicate by this, he says that if you don't do this, you cannot be my disciple. Now, there's a couple different ways you could think about that. You could think about it as, well, I won't let you be. You're not allowed. Right? But another way to think about it is you won't be able to be. Now, a disciple, of course, is one who is a learner, one who is following, one who is imitating a master. And so it makes a lot more sense when you look at the life of Jesus and realize that at the heart of his life, at the heart of what he was trying to teach all of us, is that it is the will of God that is of the utmost importance. It is our allegiance to him. It is our commitment to him. It is our love of him. It is our following of him that is the most important. Well, you can't follow a path in life that is controlled by that maxim if you are so connected to anything else that it draws you aside. You can't serve two masters. You can't go two directions at once and stay in one piece. And so it's a very understandable and not really a shocking at all statement when you realize who Jesus was, what his life, the essence of it was, and his message to those wanting to follow him. Here were the crowds, just like, oh, okay, this guy's amazing, and let's go watch him work. Let's be a follower in some sense. And he turns to them and says, well, you need to count the cost of this. You need to realize what this involves. And that, of course, is what follows in the next verses. He presents it to them as an issue of a choice that you need to measure the cost of. He says, which of you intending to build a tower sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to build it or to finish it? Now that's a very reasonable question to ask, at least apparently in this setting. I think there are a lot of settings in our modern world where that wouldn't appeal so obviously to some people. You know, you have these grand visions in government of what you're going to do, what you're going to build first, and then you figure out how you're going to get the money. Or you have a budget, and halfway through it's like, oh, we need to double that, right? No problem. We just raise taxes. A reasonable person doesn't have access to infinite resources. And so if you intend to build something, you calculate, do I have the ability to do this? And then Jesus notes, less happily, after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an embassage and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. And there again, I tell you, I think we should think of that not so much in terms of I'm not going to let you be, It's that it's impossible. You can't follow me and be tied to all these things. You can't follow me and have other things in your life which are more important. It's just not possible. And so we should appreciate it that Jesus told us that. We should. It's not like, wow, this is terrible. Why does he make this that way? No, this is just the simple truth. This is something you need to know. And it's interesting to me that he offers two somewhat detailed examples to justify this. Of all the different lessons that he gave in the New Testament, how many does he give two examples for to illustrate and appeal to your sense of reason
Is this not an extreme contrast to how the gospel is so often presented these days, in that it's a gift that you just need to accept? It just seems to me that's such a contrast.
Yeah, it is. But I do know how some people process something like this. I heard a person who, supposedly was an apologist for Christianity, that somebody asked him a question about the Gospels, and he says, well, sometimes Jesus says weird things. So I guess this would go in the weird things category for some people. But like I say, he's given enough energy to it that I'm going to be a little hesitant to call it a weird thing. It seems to be at the heart of reality. It stands among the many maxims of life which get denied by people that don't accept reality. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to pay for everything. There are no handouts. Ultimately, there are no free things. There are handouts, but there are no free things. And if you don't take into account the source of goods, then at some point you'll have to, the expression we sometimes use is pay the piper, but there will be consequences.
And when you think of how the disciples came to understand what Jesus meant when he said, follow me, they gave their lives. And so it was, they lived out what he's asking for here to the ultimate degree. That's how they understood it.
Right. But, I think I've probably, at various times in my life, taken it in the sense of, well, this is what Jesus demands, as opposed to realizing, this is the facts. You can't follow him if you're tied to anything else.
Keith, is it kind of like a math teacher saying you can't do algebra until you've mastered the multiplication tables and decimals? It's not that the teacher just doesn't want to let you move on. It's just these steps.
Sure.
In order to get here, you have to do this.
Yeah. There are prerequisites for progress.
Keith, thinking about the hating family members and in a sense the forefathers and the culture, I could see Jesus preparing his disciples, those who are following him, for what's going to be said to them. Because if they start doing what is culturally distasteful, inviting and opening up the good news to the poor, to the cripples, to people who are hurting society, to people who are probably down out because their parents sinned or they sinned.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear family members say, do you hate us? Do you hate Father Abraham? Do you hate our good name? You're going to ruin our good name. You must hate us, surely.
Sure.
And so when you think about human nature and how people try and manipulate and control others, I could see families dividing on this. And one of the things that parents or brothers, sisters, husband, wives would say is, you must hate me. Trying to make them come to this decision. Which way are you going to go? Are
right.
you going to be loyal to family, or are you going to be loyal to following Jesus? And with what Jesus says going on, Jesus is laying out very logically, think about what you're doing. And he doesn't say, don't base this on emotion or just because this is the way the crowd's moving, but is it worth the cost to you?
Yes, so I mean, I hear you salvaging the concept of hate there as it might be used, and that's, yeah, that's one way to process that. But at the end of the day, there are aspects of hate in English that Jesus doesn't want to communicate. In other words, when somebody hates somebody else, they harbor malice in their mind against them, right? So it's, oh, I hate that person. You know, I want nothing but evil for them, and I wish they would go away.
In a, maybe die.
In a graphic way. You know, and none of that is a part of a concept he wants to. But you're absolutely right. That would be a way that people use language to try and impose a guilt trip on you. You know, after I've parented you into the world and everything I've done for you, and now you don't hold me, in my opinion, in high respect. You must hate me.
You don't do what I want you to do.
Right.
My will be done.
Love less is another way to say it, I think.
Right.
Since you want the good for them, but you're not going to let them hinder your doing what you feel like God wants you to do.
Yeah, so, you know, this is language, right? So we use language to communicate reality, and sometimes the language of love and hate are used to describe the connection, the degree of influence, the level of authority in one's mind. And maybe authority is a good way to talk about it, because what tends to happen is the relationships that Jesus spoke of here are relationships which tend to have authority in your mind. My dad thinks this, therefore I have to do it. Well, yeah, there was a certain period of life where that's absolutely true. There were serious consequences for not. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the point of making a choice to follow Jesus, Jesus says, you can't take the path I'm taking if you're going to live in the realm of respecting other authorities. Right. And he has a pretty wide list there, doesn't he? He doesn't leave anything out. And the capstone is, and even your own life.
Right.
Right. So even what it is you're wanting, the good you think is necessary for you to pursue.
Because, you know, there are people, I'm human nature. I mean, I am one. And so I can, I'm sure I have experienced this myself probably when I was younger. I had a desire for what I wanted. And I could use these words to say, sorry, Mom, Dad, I'm going to do what Jesus wants me to do. And I wasn't being honest with myself.
Or another key word is biblical, right? Your position is not biblical, therefore I'm not obligated to respect it.
Yeah. A lot of misuses of...
Yeah, and unfortunately, if you look at the broader picture of somebody that's using that article's life, you look at the broader picture of their life, they're not really that concerned about what's biblical, but it's a good way to not respect what some authority in their life is saying.
And what you just brought out about unless in your own life takes care of that. If you really understand what he's saying there, that no, it's not about my desires and whims, but I'm dying to my own desires and whims as well. Not going to just use this to accomplish those. Isn't that kind of what he's addressing? The will of self, that can't over...
Right. And you know, so often we use... We use things, right? We use tools. I often say that if you have the right tool, the job's half done. You know, we can use tools in a way which is not good for us. And so we use things to get where we want to go. and to do what we want to do. And just from a consistency standpoint, I challenge myself and challenge you, if you're going to use a tool like what's biblical, then use it everywhere in your life. Don't just use it to get what you want on one issue. Now, that doesn't guarantee that you're taking the best path, but at least it guarantees you're consistent. You're not being a blatant hypocrite, which there's a pretty good chance you're in the wrong place if you're there.
Keith,
yes.
Understand that pretty much anything can be twisted and perverted, I guess, because if you use the idea of being biblical or not for your own to do what you want,
yes,
that's not biblical. So it's just hard to proceed or even do anything meaningful without being honest,
yes,
with yourself. You just that's like a basic foundation that you have to have in place before you can really move forward, because you grasp a hold of something and
yes,
turn it and pervert it, and it just does no good.
And so notice what a powerful tool that is then, in a positive sense, in whatever culture you find yourself in. Because, look, it's a big world, and people are born in a lot of different places under a lot of different circumstances. And it's hard to find simple rules that will apply everywhere, no matter where you are, that are absolutely true. But here's one that I think that is. If you find in your life that you are manipulating the words or the truth around you in order to get what you want, you're in the wrong place.
And so you really have to spend quite a bit of time trying to understand what it is that makes you tick, what you value, what you want, why you want it, what images are controlling you to accomplish the things that you desire. And that's sort of a lifetime, you keep having to...
Yeah, so if you want truth,
yeah,
if you want what's true, you have to recognize whenever you are trying to create truth to match what you want.
Mm-hmm. You're always making progress if you start the process, but I do find that I still have to say, no, wait a minute, where did that come from? Why am I pushed that direction?
And it may turn out that there are some issues that really trouble you that you realize, well, this is really not a big deal. This was a big deal in my mind, but it's not where the heart of things is. But if you want to follow Jesus, you're going to have to renounce all else. If you want the truth that he is, he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. If you want that truth, in order to go down that path, you have to lay aside all else.
Does it also help when you put Jesus first that all the other relationships actually work out better? Mm-hmm. If you put your wife first, or you put your parent first above Jesus, then those relationships can't blossom and grow as they really would have if he was first. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
That is true, although there again you have to think about the multitude of cultural settings. I know that, for instance, Bruce testifies that his pursuit of Jesus caused great friction at home. For years, it was in some cases, if you're raised in the right kind of setting, then that's absolutely true. But they produce the kind of relationships that should be positive.
Right.
Yes.
It makes me think of the scripture of seek me and I will, all these things will be added unto you. And not that you're seeking to have whatever you want added, but what's really good, it just naturally kind of flows that way. That you do have, not like you're saying, there are exceptions. People's wills are still...
And even in the negative relationships, they're better than they would have been because you're not creating... Uh-huh. A hatred that goes deeper and deeper. You're just being consistent in your life of following Jesus. So that's got to be a better situation for all parties than just a blow up.
Lack of friction doesn't equal healthy necessarily either. Mm-hmm.
And you may just have to have some distance too from some people. You can't necessarily resolve everything.
At any rate, we find Jesus putting the brakes on the popularity, celebrity effect of his life. You know, when you do the kind of things that Jesus did, you get popular fast. The feeding of the 5,000, the healing of the sick, the raising of the dead. Everybody wants to be a part of that game. But he says, whoa, better count the cost. It's not that he didn't want them, but he didn't need fans. He needed loyal followers. And there's a big difference. And so he gives two detailed illustrations here to talk about the importance of assessing the real issues, the real cost of following him.
Keith, there's yes. an article in the most recent edition of God's Revival, skimmed over, and it's in agreement with what you say. It's saying it in different words, and the gist of it, what I read, was a lot of people want to add Jesus to their life, but what Jesus is asking is that we make him the central figure of our life.
Yes.
Everything else is to be arranged according to him.
Yes. And that's not an unreasonable request.
When he knows what's good.
Yeah. It's just coming into harmony with what is real, what is true. Okay. So then Luke here has included in this account a passage which is real similar to a passage in Matthew chapter 5 about salt. He says, salt is good, but if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Now you may remember from Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, that in that passage, Jesus says, ye are the salt of the earth. And if the earth has lost its savor, so on and so forth. A slightly different take on that. But in this context in particular, it seems a bit abrupt. And where did this come from, right? What is the point of this? And I was musing recently about this, and I thought, I wonder if there weren't some sayings of the rabbis that might somehow have been referenced here. If this meant more to this audience than it does to us, right off. And I think a lot of times I have been helped by going down that path. If I have a passage, it's like, I just don't get that. I don't see its connections. I don't see where it's coming from. And then if you try to get some insight into the ancient culture of the day, sometimes it really turns on some light bulbs. And so I did a little research and found a few things that I'll share with you here on the right-hand side. I don't know if you can read them or not. Once the sages taught, and the sages refers to the Jewish rabbis, and this comes, the examples given here come out of the Talmud. Okay, so the Talmud was written down in about the 2nd century AD, but it was based on tradition that went back even before the time of Jesus. So it's not out of a reason to think that these were ideas which were circulating in his time. Once the sages taught that there were three partners in bringing a human into this world. Between the father and mother, they each contributed to the child's physical makeup. Life itself, the soul, and the mind come from God. They explained that when a person dies, God simply takes back his portion and leaves the rest. Then the sages quoted an old saying that everybody knew at that time, if you take the salt out of meat, you might as well throw it to the dog, or to a dog. So one of the essential properties of salt in the ancient world was the preservation of meat. No refrigeration, no ice, no deep freeze. How long does meat last like that? Well, without salt, not long at all. Might as well give it to the dogs. On another occasion, the sages asked the daughter of a rich man how she ended up penniless. She quoted a common secular proverb, "There is no salt for wealth." Okay, so how do you keep wealth? Why did you lose your wealth? Well, you can preserve meat by adding salt to it, but there's no salt for wealth. Interesting thought. In other words, you can preserve meat with salt. There's no way to ensure that your wealth will last forever. The sages taught her the Jewish version of the saying, giving is salt for wealth. They had the same concept in mind as Jesus when he said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break through and steal. Salt appears in another popular saying around the first century. The philosophers of Athens posed a question to Rabbi Joshua, one of the leading sages at the time. If salt begins to spoil, with what do you preserve it? Okay, so this is, you see, the same vein as if the salt has lost its savor, if it's lost its saltiness, if it's lost its essential characteristic of...
That's possible?
No.
Okay. Salt's always salt.
Although in the ancient world, salt was often a combination of stuff. It included some sodium chloride, maybe some potassium chloride. There's a number of salts, and as well as some sand. I mean, if you look at salt, just to look at it, what's the difference in salt and sand? Texture-wise, and not much. So in their experience, not knowing... the chemical dimension of it. But anyway, here's the, you know, this is the kind of things that, you know, philosophers have always been worried about. It hasn't always been how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but also if salt spoils, what do you preserve it with? This Greek witticism has a rhetorical point beyond being a nerdy conversation starter. If the agent you are using to protect society becomes compromised, it is useless and the community is in trouble. The Roman satirist had a similar but more blunt question. Who watches the watchman? Okay. In their debate with Rabbi Joshua, the Greek philosophers used the phrase to challenge Judaism's claim that the Torah preserves society. What if the Torah fails? So the Torah is the law, the Jewish law. With what do you preserve the spoiling salt of Torah? Rabbi Joshua has had a very clever comeback. And it's a little abrupt. But here's what it is. With the afterbirth of a mule. But mules can't give birth, the philosophers objected. Nor can salt spoil, Rabbi Joshua said. In other words, the Torah will never fail to preserve society. So, there's a little more context to think about the saying of Jesus here about salt. And we'll look at it a little bit more next week. Thank you for your attention.
Special.